This
can see
conference will
everything. I
now
can
be
hear.
recorded.
Okay. So I can start the meeting, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, good afternoon and Happy New Year to everyone that is attending the meeting. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is going to be a very, very exciting meeting. We have two very interesting presentations. We have received their PowerPoints, and we look forward to hearing from them. But officially, the first item in the agenda is really the approval of the minutes on November 18th. So I will need a motion.
Stella, this is Denise.
Yes.
You need to take a roll call of the members.
Oh my God. And I don't have the name. I know Peter Lisi is here because I can see him. I see Susan Martin, who's a member of the Grant Committee. And I see Mike Angeli. Is that you, Mike?
It is. Thanks, Estella, but I'm not a member of the committee.
No, that's okay. But you shave your beard, right?
Just so I can be on this call, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So let the minutes reflect that Mike is clean shaven.
Yeah. Thank you, Peter. Who else is a member of the committee that I haven't called upon? Anybody else?
Lawrence up there.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming, for joining us, Lauren. Anybody else?
Okay.
So then we can move to the approval of the minutes, having done the attendance, the roll call. So I would need a motion for the approval of the minutes.
I'll move it, Stella.
And I'll second.
Thank you. Any objections, changes? Then all those in favor, just raise your hand.
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Thank you. And then the next item of the agenda is really a presentation by Tiffany Donaldson, who is a friend of mine, and we have serving several boards together, and I'm delighted that we were able to invite her to come today because her work is very fundamental to the issues of this year and of you know, this century. So she's the president of the Connecticut Health Foundation. I know Betty will do a formal introduction. So Betty, go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. Sorry that I'm having technical issues with my camera. It's my pleasure to welcome Tiffany Donaldson, the president and CEO of the Connecticut Health Foundation. We have included Tiffany's bio with her impressive background and experience in the materials sent yesterday. Tiffany has been a trusted philanthropic colleague for many years. As we utilize our grant committee meetings for learning opportunities, we thought that asking Tiffany to speak about the health sector was the logical choice. COVID-19 has laid bare the already prevalent health inequities in our state. We appreciate Tiffany taking the time to present to us today on this very important topic. Tiffany?
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. And I believe now I'm going to be able to share my screen. Please let me know if you can see the screen in front of you, if you can see my presentation.
Yes, we can.
Excellent. Well, thank you all so much for having me. And I really thank Betty for inviting me here today to your meeting. And I know that it is hard sometimes in a virtual environment, but I do hope that we have a conversation around health equity, what it looks like in our state, and as Betty already alluded to, what the impact of COVID-19 has meant for populations of color and for health equity across the state of Connecticut. I think similar to our board, you all have had some very tough days and challenging decisions around grant making, which is often challenging at any time, but especially at times during COVID-19. And I just want to start by thanking you all as an organization, as a board, for your acknowledgement and for your interest in health equity. So I just want to also acknowledge that. Our goals today are very simple. And again, as much as we can make this a conversation, it would be wonderful. It's just for you all to get to understand who we are as a foundation just a little bit. I'll just give you a quick glimpse of that. But really the focus is to talk about where we stand with health equity across our state, and again, what the impact of COVID-19 has been for the state of Connecticut, and what we can do about it. So some considerations around how we all can consider our work, and what are some options for how we move forward as a state. Just who are we? The Connecticut Health Foundation is the state's largest health philanthropy. We are solely focused on health, and we have been around since 1999. From the very beginning of our organization, and just so you all know, we are a conversion foundation. So when ConnectiCare, the insurance company, went for profit, they started our organization with an endowment so that we can move forward health equity here in our state. So as a state, as an organization, we have always been statewide, and we have always been focused on the elimination of health disparities here in the state of Connecticut. I'll note, however, that it was in 2013 as an organization that we explicitly named race. So our organization, we say that we are focused on health equity specifically for people of color. And we made that decision primarily because we looked at the data and we recognize that regardless of race, income, education, and looking across all the continuums, race was really the primary factor that was rising as we looked at some of the inequities. So we figured we'd focus on race and name it as an organization. We do our work through grant making, public policy research, strategic communications, and we even do leadership development as well. Our focus is on systems change. And if I asked any of you, I know, and even as I even asked my staff and my board, what is systems change to you? It's different for everybody. But for us, we recognize that even with an endowment, our dollars are decimal dust compared to the larger healthcare dollars in the state of Connecticut. So we are constantly looking for ways that we really can impact the policies and legislation, as well as the practices that really impact the health of Connecticut residents. So we do spend a lot of time looking at public policy, funding grant making that is associated with advocacy, and also really strong strategic communications around how do we change the hearts and minds of decision makers and of people around the state and really thinking about health equity. And we do this work with a board similar to you all who are very energized and committed to the work. We also have a community advisory committee, and this is a committee of individuals who are from and of the community that help us keep a pulse on whether or not we are moving in the right direction as it relates to health equity. And of course, I know your staff, and again, I appreciate their invitation. We also do so with the committed staff, as you all have a committed staff, but our staff with commitment around health equity across the state. I keep saying health equity. Keep naming it health equity, health equity, health equity. Similar to systems change, if I asked each of you, if I asked around even to some of our partners, what does health equity mean to you? We will all probably have different definitions. So I'd like to pause as I continue to use the term to just say that we define health equity as everyone having the ability to live their healthiest lives, regardless of race, income, or socioeconomic status here in Connecticut. And when we say have the opportunity to live their healthiest lives, again, assuring that our state has the right policies and has the right practices, and that our health systems have the right practices in place, that they are creating an environment that people can live their healthiest lives. And so we look at health equity as creating that environment. And again, what is health equity? Oftentimes we talk about, it can be said that, you know, the equality is the state at which each person in has the being and the status and the rights and the same opportunities. And I use this example, and some of you have probably seen this before, of the fact that oftentimes we conflate equality with equity. We look at the distribution of our resources and we say, even in our state, well, everyone is getting the same, so it should be okay. But if you look at this picture, you'll see that although there are three boxes, everyone in this picture needs to be able to see over that fence and in a different way. So just simply saying we're going to equally distribute our resources to help everybody isn't really the correct way to approach it. However, when we look at equity, it's really thinking about how are we distributing our resources as a state so that we really can assure that everyone is seeing over that fence. How are we looking at assuring that we are directing our resources to the populations and into the work where we really need to build equity? And it doesn't mean that we are adding more resources. You see, there are still three boxes, but that we're thinking about the distribution of our resources to really impact those who need the most help. Again, it's looking at our resources to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to live their healthiest lives. We are looking at ways that everyone has the opportunity to see over the fence. And even if that means that we are distributing our resources to those who have the least. And that is the way that we look at equity. The other piece of it is that, and you'll hear me say that it's also around the elimination of health disparities and health inequities. Health equity is, again, making sure that our policies and our state and our the way that we look at healthcare is promoting as a system everyone living their healthiest lives. The elimination of health disparities is reducing the burden on racial groups. It's looking at, and I have some future slides so that we can see, it's looking at the disease burden that certain populations have and assuring that we can reduce that and avoiding the differences in the healthcare access and outcomes and really bridging the gap so that we can make sure that everyone eventually is looking as healthy as that the entire Connecticut population is looking their healthiest. And I say this because oftentimes, even in our national work, and I speak nationally and have these conversations, and I say we're focused on health equity for people of color in Connecticut, other states will look at me and they will say, well, Connecticut is healthy. And mm-hmm. It's true. We're a healthy state. Connecticut was ranked the fourth healthiest state in the country in 2019. But if you look at the data more closely, we were also ranked 41st in the nation for disparities. So that means that if you look across our population, we look healthy, we look fine. But if you start to tease out and look at our data by race, ethnicity, and language, you will see that there really are two Connecticuts. There is the Connecticut that is reflecting the majority that is healthy, but there is a Connecticut that is very unhealthy. So we may be on top as a state related to health, but we are at the bottom 10 as it relates to health disparities. And that's why we are focused on this work overall. And that's why we also are encouraging organizations to look at this work. Because again, this is not just impacting us every day. We've seen the impact with COVID-19, and I'll continue to get to that. But I do want to pause and just, again, I'm going to pause throughout and see if anyone has any questions on what I have presented so far on health equity versus health disparities and all of this data. Okay, I will continue. One of the ways that we also look at health disparities and health inequities in our state is just looking across at life expectancy. So if you look at our data overall, again, this is where we're often ranked one of the healthiest states, is because we have as a state a very high life expectancy. But again, if you tease and even look by communities, you'll see that in Northeast Hartford, and this is the north end of Hartford that we often talk about, there is about over an 11-year difference in life expectancy. And I will even go a little bit deeper because I've looked at this data even more. If you look at the life expectancy in West Hartford versus the west end of the north end of Hartford, which is literally 3 miles apart, you have a 10-year difference in life expectancy. So that means just living 3 miles from each other, you can live longer depending on where you are. And again, the north end of Hartford or northeast Hartford is primarily with people of color. So 69% Black and 29% Hispanic. If you look at Westport as another example, they have one of the highest life expectancies here in Connecticut overall. And you'll see their ethnic and racial background. So again, our neighborhoods and where we live, what we do is so critical to how we are able to survive and thrive here, even in our state. Here's some data that shows up. So how does this show up in everyday issues that we have and see around health? So if you look at the infant mortality in Connecticut, again, and I'm going to keep saying this because I know the data because I live and breathe this, Connecticut as a state is often recognized as having one of the greatest infant mortality rates in the country, meaning that we have low infant mortality rates, which is phenomenal for us in as we're looking at it overall compared to the nation. But if you look at the data broken down by race and ethnicity, you will see that non-Hispanic Blacks have significantly more infant mortality than whites, 3 times as much. And the same thing for the Hispanic community, where they have almost twice as much issues around infant mortality. We typically as an organization use this as an example because the practices around childbirth and around caring for women, they're standard practices that have been established for several years. So this should be, in theory, an equalizer across all populations. We know how to keep moms and babies healthy. But yet we have a significant amount of disparity in this area in our state. We've done some additional research as an organization, and we've found, and this is nationally, that a woman of color, particularly a Black woman with a college degree, is still 1.5 more times likely to die after having a baby than a white woman with a high school diploma. So this is an area where we are seeing significant racial and ethnic disparities, regardless of race and income. And one of the areas I will note that the state of Connecticut is really looking at. So we work with a lot of our state partners, and the Department of Social Services is really interested in looking at child and maternal health because they also see this as an opportunity for us to demonstrate as a state how we can achieve health equity. Another example is just thinking about diabetes. And I use this is an example that I typically like to use because conditions as diabetes and asthma are controllable. People should not be dying from these conditions. And yet, if we look at our state, you will see just a few years ago that people of color, and this has been consistent across the years, are dying significantly more of this controllable illness than others in our state. And again, this is another area that even our state departments are looking at because they too recognize that people should, first of all, not be dying of diabetes, but more importantly, we shouldn't be seeing these disparities because we know what it takes to keep people healthy in these areas. So I showed you some data, and oftentimes people are thinking, well, why is this happening? Why is this happening across our state and frankly across the nation as well? And a lot of the causes for disparities have to do with access, resource, desperate treatment in our system, in our medical system, as well as just the effects of racism. One thing we like to note, and again, I'm giving a very high level presentation, and Betty, I am keeping an eye on time as well, is that it is not genetics, which is often assumed, and all the data has shown us that. We have done, again, a lot of work around thinking about what is preventing people of color from being healthier. And I'm just going to quickly show this slide that just shows that a lot of what impacts our health, and we all know this, a lot of what impacts our health happens outside of the hospital walls. It's what we do related to eating, where we live, our educational attainment. It has everything to do with what people often call the social determinants of health. So what are all those social factors that really help us be or live our healthiest lives? I will say throughout this presentation that I call it the social drivers of health. The reason why I don't like to call it determinants is because these things can be changed. Nothing has to be determinant. There's no reason why our state cannot create a way in which people have equal access to transportation, equal access to food and neighborhood safety and affordable housing. That should not be a determinant. It is a driver, but it's something that we need to continue to drive to change. And you'll see in this quick diagram all of the differences in the way that there is desperate access to all of these things. And this is part of the reason why there are disparities in our state. The other piece that we look at and as an organization and have looked at is just the impact of race. And again, I use the example of child and maternal health because if you think about income and education, that example shows that it's not just that that is causing some of the disparities that we've seen. And all the studies nationally have shown that there is just different treatment for people of color when they enter into the healthcare system, on top of the ongoing impacts of racism and discrimination. I'm going to quickly go through some of these studies, and these studies are coming from the JAMA. They are coming from the New England Medical Society. So these are not studies that are just from small publications. A lot of publications have looked at, and a lot of medical professionals have looked at some of the desperate treatment around, again, treatment for people of color. And it's shown that people of color get pain medications less likely, even for proven things like a broken bone. So Hispanic patients are half as likely to get pain medications for broken bones when they enter in the ER. I use the second bullet because people often ask, why has the opiate epidemic impacted, in particularly middle class white communities, even more than others? And this is the perfect example. So this study is from JAMA that occurred back in 1990 that showed that Black kids and teens were less likely to get opioids for pain treatment for appendicitis. And again, back then, 20 years ago, this was a proven treatment to help ease the pain. But yet, because of the way that our system is treating Black and Brown people differently, they weren't even getting the pain treatment that they deserve when they enter in the healthcare system. And that's why, in many ways, the opioid epidemic is hitting communities differently, because people of color are less likely to just get the pain medications that they deserve, even when they enter in the healthcare system. The last bullet is around heart issues and the fact that Black patients, and again, this is a national study, were less likely to get interventions for prolonged long-term survival. And part of it is just that our system, unfortunately, our country is just rooted in some myths about race and the ability for people of color to handle pain more, and also what life is worth saving. And unfortunately, it's reflected in, again, our own healthcare system. some of the studies also show that, you know, just the impacts of racism really impact people. It's because of the macro and the micro aggressions that individuals have to deal with that really cause increased depression, anxiety, hypertension, and even thinking about birth and preterm. It's the stress of just living in an environment where oftentimes people of color are told that their life is not valued as much as others and are dealing with the implications of that and how challenging that can be, it impacts one's health. What are we doing as an organization? So I gave you all the problems, but what are we doing at the Connecticut Health Foundation? We're focused on making sure people have access. They can get through the door and that they have access to our healthcare system. One of the areas that we really are directing a lot of energy as well is thinking about the collection of race, ethnicity, and language data. Just making sure, again, that our state pays attention to the disparities that we are seeing and that our hospitals do as well so that they can build some interventions in. I talked about the social drivers of health. We are focused on community health workers. And just to take a step back, community health workers are a workforce of individuals who are from and of the community. So these are people who are living in their community who understand the healthcare system, as well as understanding the needs of their community. And they are a conduit to connect people to the social drivers that will keep them healthy. So we really are focused on making sure community health workers are funded and a sustainable part of our workforce. I talked about some of the fact that we have evidence-based practices. So we're really trying to assure that all of our health systems understand those evidence-based practices that should not be determined or used based upon race, but that should be uniformly exercised across a healthcare system. And then the last piece is tying those evidence-based practices and tying the fact that we should keep all populations healthy to our healthcare economy overall. So when we talk about value-based care, it's thinking about treating a person and getting paid for not how often you see a person, but for how healthy they are. So moving our healthcare system away from I get reimbursed when you walk through the door to I get reimbursed if I keep you healthy and I keep you whole. So moving towards value is another area that we are looking at. I know I want to leave some time for questions, so I'm just going to talk very briefly about how COVID-19 impacted, because this is where we are today. And again, all those social drivers showed up in COVID-19. COVID-19 just illuminated the inequities in our state and in across the nation, frankly. And even as we think about frontline workers and who's able to work from home to keep themselves safe, as you can see from the statistics, Black and Hispanics are least likely able to work from home. So they are out there. They are exposed to COVID-19 more often than others. The other piece is savings and being able to withstand all the loss of income. People of color are less likely to do so at any time, but especially through COVID-19. And lastly, you know, I talked about some of the disparities around diabetes. Well, those same disparities show up in asthma and hypertension, which, as many of us learned through this pandemic, COVID-19 really, really hurts those who have any kind of comorbidities, who have any of these conditions. People are more likely to get COVID-19 and more likely to die from COVID-19. And that's what we saw. So this data is coming from our own Department of Public Health. And if you look at the age-adjusted deaths in Connecticut, people of color, and this is some of the most recent data, so this was taken as of 2 weeks ago, people of color in Connecticut are dying twice as much as white individuals here, and in particular, Blacks are dying twice as much, and Hispanics are dying around 1.7% more than whites. And again, that has to do with the fact that we are getting the condition more, and that we also have more of the comorbidities that cause us to really be impacted by COVID-19. taking what we know about health disparities, this is some of the work that we've done for our COVID-19 response. One of our largest initiatives is that we really funded and we spent over close to $1.8 million to assure that community health workers were a part of the COVID-19 response. And we really did this by helping local health departments incorporate COVID community health workers into their COVID response. And the community health workers are doing everything from contact tracing to connecting people to the needed resources to helping them quarantine, everything. The other thing that we have recognized and we are continuously working on is making sure that we are hearing from those who are most impacted by COVID-19. So we started a cross-sector collaborative, and this is individuals that are representing organizations and communities to tell us how is COVID-19 showing up and what do we need to improve. We not only are hearing from them, but we connected them with our state decision makers. So they have already met with commissioners from the Department of Social Services, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction, from Commissioner Porter, who is running a lot of our COVID-19 work in the state. And so we are connecting them to decision makers so that we can improve the response of Connecticut related to COVID-19. One of the really important things that we are seeing as well with COVID-19 that is happening throughout is that the messenger for any information, especially in communities of color, the messenger is more important than the message. Mm-hmm. So what we recognized was that even when COVID-19 happened and we were saying the basic things, stay socially distanced, wear a mask, we were talking to our health departments, we were talking to community members, and that message was not resonating. So we created a fund where we have provided dollars to those who are trusted in their community to do the messaging. And this is important, and I highlight this as we're doing the vaccine education and distribution. We're continuing this work because, again, we're recognizing that the messenger for, in particular for communities of color, having a trusted messenger is more important than even what we are messaging, because they want to hear from those who they believe understand them and understand what's happening. And so it's important that we continue to think about, with our vaccine education and distribution, who is providing the message, and so that we can really reach communities in the way that we need. And as many of you, we also funded basic needs, recognizing that COVID was going to impact communities of color in ways unimaginable. So I'm going to stop sharing here and in my slideshow, and I'm trying to hear you. Here you all are. I'm sharing at this point, and oh, it looks. I just want to pause and see if you have any questions.
Oh. Hey, Tiffany, that's a great presentation. I'm very powerful. I'm going to ask my fellow board members if they have questions. I do have some questions, but I want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity. So thank you so much for the information, the data, and the presentation of issues. Peter, you wanted to ask a question? You had your hand raised?
Well, actually, I'm playing with my pen here, but yes, I do have a question. Tiffany, I want to echo what Estella just said. It was a fascinating presentation. But my question would be, you know, you focused, or the statistics focus a lot on race and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And how it impacts things, whether it be you know, access to healthcare or transportation or food. But there's also tremendous economic disparity in Connecticut. So how does lack of economic resources impact all the other items that you were describing today? I guess that would be my question. If there was less economic disparity, would there be less disparity in access to healthcare and the things you described?
Yes. And can you all hear me?
Yes.
I, Okay, perfect. Because it's saying, for some reason, it's my computer is saying I'm muted. So I was making sure you all could hear me. And I think you bring up a really good point, Peter, that we cannot delineate. And the fact that economically, there is a lot of disparity across our state, and we have seen that. I will say a couple of things. Unfortunately, most of the economic disparity, the burden of that is with communities of color. So focusing on the economy and giving some economic equality across Connecticut will definitely improve access. But that also means, again, making sure that we are redirecting our resources accurately, that we are looking across our state and understanding who's most in an impacted and desperate situation, and that we are directing our resources as such, which we don't do so well as a state. We tend to keep our own within our own towns. And listen, I live in a wealthy town, so I admittedly have to say that, you know, I understand how it goes, but we tend to not think about how do we look across our state and really direct resources to improve the economy for all individuals. The other piece is, again, there are some conditions that we have looked at, again, using child and maternal health, that even if you have money and you have education, there are still disparities. So there is twofold that there is definitely, if we focus on it, and that's why we also focus and look at how are we building our communities and their economy, and we can't separate the economy from health. But we also have to understand that there are some conditions that just being a person of color means that you're not going to do as well in the healthcare system. So you, right. it's and. It's not a but, it's an and.
Understood. Thank you.
Other questions for Tiffany? Tiffany, let me ask you.
Yeah, I just want to just share with the board that I sit on another board, Health Equity Solutions.
Yes.
Which is an offshoot that was created by Connecticut Health Foundation. And that particular board, you know, actively is out there in terms of trying to drive legislation, action steps in terms of addressing the inequity of the distribution of health to the population. And so, you know, I'm very familiar with what Tiffany has brought up and talked about, and just wanted to let the board know that, you know, there's a lot of effort that's being made and being done to go ahead, and because this is a very real issue. Thank you,
Lawrence. Tiffany, I know you've been doing this work for so many years, and this is such a critical work, and I'm a caretaker now, and I am so much aware of the necessity to have an advocate in any instance when you have to work with the healthcare system. And that for many communities, that lack of advocacy is part of the many challenges. But what I wanted was, because this is like, you know, I know Peter asked about the economy, and I know, you know, you live in a certain area, whatever. But in terms of things that are very concrete, that you have seen that work, you talk about, and I do believe what you said about community, yes, communication from a trusted community. What are two or three things that you know are working and are making an impact that that you know we should be aware of them?
Excellent question. You talk about having an advocate, community health workers. I cannot hone in on that enough. Community health workers can be the advocates for those who may not be able to understand or even have the resources or the tools to advocate for themselves. They typically are phenomenal resources. And again, our state is really focused on community health workers. So that's an area that organizations can continue to think about you know, a workforce organizations continue to think about focusing on. Last thing with community health workers, they also are important for the economy because it provides a way for people who are from the community to really develop a job that is sustainable and a part of the workforce, and that again will improve their overall their family's economy because it provides a pathway for that. Another area that's really important, again, it's just thinking about how people have access to the system. Some of the things that we can do is around Medicaid access and access to insurance and affordable care. We all need that. We know how expensive health insurance is, but thinking and focusing on how do we assure that people have access to care is exceptionally, exceptionally critical in an area that we all can think about and we all can work on. And then I will say that lastly, we have to hold our entire system accountable. That's why we talk so much about the data. No one improves what they don't measure. Across the board, we don't improve what we don't measure. I think it's important for us to continue to have our state, and it's not just for health, but looking across all issues, looking across our economy, looking across education, that we really push that information is by race, ethnicity, and language. So again, we understand how the full picture of Connecticut, not the broader picture of Connecticut. So those are some areas that we know have worked. When we pay attention to the data, when we focus on access, and when we create a workforce that can really help people on the ground and individually, we've seen it work, not just in our state, but across the country.
Tiffany, thank you so much. We wish
thank
we
you
had
all.
More time.
And I see some of our partners are joining. So good to see you, Kim and Russ. Good seeing you guys.
Very thoughtful presentation. Betty, we're ready to move to the next. And the next one is really looking at one of the agencies that we funded as a grant follow-up activity. So Betty, will you introduce the Community Health Center Association of Connecticut, please?
Yes, thank you, Estella, and thank you again to Tiffany for an excellent presentation and discussion. We're also using our grant committee meetings to highlight one of our more important grants. Today, we have Ken Lalim, CEO, and Russell Dexter, the Chief Quality Officer of the Community Health Center Association of Connecticut. Their bios have also been included with the material sent yesterday. Their organization received the largest of our COVID-19 grants in the amount of $486,000, and we've asked them to provide an update on the grant today. Russ and Ken?
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for having us. We're also very pleased to be able to provide some information, albeit not totally baked yet, as we continue to roll it out and continue to take advantage of these opportunities to get in front of our providers and educate them as to how important the relationships that they're building day to day are. So the grant committee, it's great to be in front of you. We have the next slide if we could. The intent of what we're trying to accomplish with this wonderful grant that you've provided is to basically connect and reconnect patients to their primary care physician via a very broad word called telehealth. So that's the major focus. Telehealth takes on lots of different avenues. There's lots of ways of describing telehealth. The way I look at it, it's using technology in assisted manners around events and services to better connect again to the primary care physician, and with a long-term goal as a precursor to more home monitoring. We have found over time that the best place for a patient to recover after surgery or other situations, medical situations, the home environment can provide so much more than institutional environments. And institutions, when needed, obviously are there, but that home care version of the world. And telehealth fits right into that, whether that be an automated way of doing a consult to a specialist that you can't get access to, whether it's devices in the home that can actually provide information electronically to a call center, which can then screen that information and get care to the patient at the right place at the right time as fast as possible. And that's what we're building here. We're building some of those, as you'll see as we go along, some of the actual items that we have that the health centers are actually purchasing with us. So if they get a portion of the dollars, and then they'll actually receive goods that will help them do what I just explained. So it's a precursor to all the home monitoring, et cetera. As far as the grant goes right now, we've only had first 2 months of experience reporting wise. We'll get more, and Russ will get into some of the detail, but we've spent about 18% of the dollars so far on these items and others, and look forward to having the rest of that moved over in the next few months. So what is this references that we make to acronyms? So CHCACT, CHC Act, or we are the primary care association sanctioned by the federal government for the state of Connecticut. We provide advocacy, training, technical assistance for the health centers in the state of Connecticut. 16 of the 17 centers, and we've identified them here on this map, 16 of the 17 centers that are in the state are part of our membership, and the CEOs of those organizations are our board of directors. And as shown here, our membership provides services across the entire state, serving in excess of 300,000 patients on a regular basis. That's about one in every 13 or 14 citizens in the state use the health centers. And we generate about 2 million visits, 2 million patient visits a year. Now, some of those are converting. We're actually doing some studies right now that Russ will talk to a little bit into this. On the use of those services, it used to be, you know, how many visits did you have? Now it's telehealth visits versus regular visits. And when is the appropriate use of those services? So telehealth is just, you guys picked a wonderful topic for having access to this type of information. It is moving fast, it is really efficient, and it provides great information. As Tiffany was mentioning, the use of data and the access to data and the accumulation of the data that we can get on how effective these types of services are will go a long way as we move forward. So in the role of the FQHCs, these are federally qualified health centers that we help manage. Our members provide comprehensive primary care, truly one-stop shop. It's primary care, it's preventive care, it is actually integrated primary care and behavioral health care. And that's a very unique thing. Very few organizations and very few states actually have that totally integrated process. In other words, I go to see my medical provider and there may be something that I need that extra level of comfort that all my needs are being met. You know, let's go down the hall and meet with practitioner X and have a behavioral health consult in literally the same space. And it's very unique. Most often those types of services require, okay, we'll see you today for your medical services, and then we'll book an appointment for you next week to come in for your behavioral health services. Such a large percentage of that second event don't take place. And it's a tragedy, because that is behavioral health services, especially while we're going through the pandemic, are so needed, and so many patients are in a situation where that's needed. That integrated model is just a fabulous way of keeping that patient intact. So besides the behavioral health and primary care services, we also provide primary dental health services at all the centers. Some provide specialty care in some aspects, and as well as some are now providing pharmacy services on site. But this is to all patients, regardless of age or ability to pay. Very unique. Well, most people say, gee, you got a captured audience, you got all these patients, how wonderful, but it doesn't matter. That is not the criteria that we would use. Many do, but that ability to pay issue is a big deal. Because they're also located in underserved urban and rural communities, they serve a very, very disproportionate amount of Connecticut's vulnerable populations. Examples of vulnerable populations, 75% of patients are represented by racial and ethnic minorities. 90% of patients have patients have income under 200% of the federal poverty limit, 16% are uninsured, 62% are Medicaid. Approximately 25% of patients are served best by a primary language other than English. So it's a very broad, robust community that we are. And it is, when we mention this, you can't mention it enough, this is a community of care. Truly, the community health centers are a central focus in many of the communities around the state. Health centers also have programs to bring care to vulnerable populations in the community that aren't necessarily behind the bricks and mortar world. Migrant farmer workers, homeless patients. We try to get to many of those through mobile vans and bringing the medical care to the community. So it isn't just one place to have that service provided. So Connecticut's health centers have been on the front lines of all of these things moving forward. Can I have this next slide, please? And I'm going to now turn it over to Russ as he goes through how the mechanics of what the grant has provided us and what those, plus the intangibles. When we actually got the grant, got the award, we were extremely pleased. It had just, the pandemic was just blossoming, if you would. And literally the ability to use the technologies and stuff that we're going to describe have been a superb way of introducing this to the marketplace. So Russ, I'm going to turn it over to you to carry on.
Thank you, Ken. And the rest of the presentation is really going to be framed around how our health centers responded to the pandemic, what need that created for the health centers and their patients, and how they've been able to use your generous funding to address some of that need. So when, as Ken indicated, health centers, they're really at the front lines of this pandemic. They've been from the start. And as it took hold early spring, they needed to respond to the new reality of restricted in-person interaction and scarce supplies of personal protective equipment to transition almost overnight from a model of in-person care to one of telehealth, as Ken alluded to. This created a number of challenges for them. Some of those included, you know, navigating all the policy and guidelines regarding implementing telehealth. They had to address things like their ability to actually bill for providing telehealth services, particularly telehealth, not so much from video, but from telephone. They had to look at get licensing waivers from the Department of Public Health in order for the providers who weren't in the health centers, who were actually operating from home, to be able to conduct their telehealth visits from home. They had the challenge of very quickly having to select telehealth platforms in order to be able to communicate with their patients. And the workflows that go around with supporting those platforms and patient engagement when you have members of the care team who are completely at remote, different locations. I think probably most importantly, they had to change patient attitudes towards receiving telehealth. And this is something I'm going to touch on a little more as we move through the presentation. But there are also technology barriers for the patients. You know, they didn't, when it's trying to engage through video, they may not have internet access. They may not have phone enough time or minutes on their phone to conduct a 45-minute behavioral health session. And so, as Ken alluded to, these are the vulnerable populations in the communities throughout Connecticut. These are the populations that Tiffany referenced in her presentation. And what our health centers are faced with was the challenge of bringing telehealth directly to these populations within a framework of them having their own existing barriers to care and having to overcome those. What we did find out, the good news is anecdotal information indicates that although it took a while for patients to embrace telehealth, once they embraced it, they were very much in favor of it, and they enjoyed being able to engage their providers in the ease of doing so and the convenience of doing so through telehealth platforms. And so as our health centers scrambled and got these telehealth models in place, what the next thing in terms of their response to the pandemic had to do with testing. And the state had approached us about being involved in a high-risk testing program. And the program was designed to provide free testing to high-risk communities throughout the state, as well as those communities that were experiencing high positivity rates. You know, as the pandemic progressed and we saw flare-ups here and there, which
obviously eventually turned into an entire state, but we, but our health centers were on the ground trying to identify opportunities to address these flare-ups to minimize their impact and minimize their spread. Our health centers implemented community walk-up and driving testing events at their health centers. They also worked with their community partners to develop pop-up testing, like faith-based communities, faith-based partners, as well as other partners, to make sure to go where the patients were in order to bring the testing opportunity to them. In addition to the testing, many of our health centers provide other services such as food distribution, voter registration at these testing events as ways to provide services to these patients at this time of need. Now, over since August, mostly, our health centers have been heavily involved in this high-risk testing program. Collectively, the health centers in Connecticut have conducted over 285,000 tests, over 3,000 testing events. And I just want to emphasize that because those tests and those events are being held in the communities that are disproportionately affected by this pandemic. The role of Connecticut's health center were crucial in controlling the spread and making sure that those that were disproportionately affected were able to get tested. And then beyond the test, our health centers were able to provide follow-up care where needed, using telehealth platforms for those that were positive for the virus, be able to engage them in their care at home, and also connect them with community services. It's another valuable role that our health centers play, is connecting their patients to community services to address needs such as housing or needs such as addressing food insecurity and other things. So health centers played that follow-up role within these communities once patients were identified as being positive for the virus. Then now, as we see the pandemic really shifting into a new phase, and that has to do with finally the administration of the vaccine, our health centers are once again playing an active role. They've been involved with the phase 1A, that is vaccinating their own staff, as well as vaccinating staff from other healthcare organizations. And now they're beginning the process of rolling out phase B, reaching out to the elderly population to get them and get them vaccinated. And they also had conversations just yesterday about how they might develop a mass vaccination program, some of them, in order to support the broader needs of the communities to provide convenient access to vaccinations. So this is the response that Connecticut's health centers have been providing in the pandemic in order to address the needs of the high-risk communities and vulnerable communities throughout the state of Connecticut. Doing this is obviously created, next slide, please.
With all due respect, we do have a board meeting that starts in a few minutes, and we really appreciate listening to everything you're sharing, but I unfortunately would need to ask you to begin to wrap up so we can be on time for our board meeting. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Okay, so I'm gonna kind of go through this very briefly. You know, some of the barriers had to do with, you know, the fact that as Tiffany's mentioned, that they're really the social barriers to care were exacerbated by the pandemic. Patients had to get comfortable, as I alluded to earlier, with this new concept of telehealth. Go ahead, next slide, please. As Ken alluded to, there's 17 health centers in the state, 16 of them are members. What we did is we took your generous funding and we allocated it evenly throughout the members. And we had conducted a needs assessment of them early on the pandemic to identify things that they needed in order to facilitate their response to the pandemic. Three key areas came up. One had to do with providing patient care kits, and this is very important. This is a critical tool for our health centers to engage vulnerable populations, and these kits consisted of equipment such as a thermometer, pulse oximeter, blood pressure monitor, spirometer, some Tylenol, but these were kits that patients could take back to home, back to their residence, and use it to monitor and be activated in their care. It was very important for them to feel like they had some control over understanding what the symptoms were. They were valuable tools for the providers to know when it was important for the patient to receive higher levels of care. Looking at when patients feel like they're short of breath, when they've got the virus, understanding they can monitor their oxygen levels, understanding when to contact a provider for a telehealth visit, or when they really need to go to the ED. So these care kits were instrumental in building that confidence and trust in the patients that telehealth could be an effective option for them, and also reduce barriers to transportation and obviously the need to stay isolated so they weren't affecting others or potentially being affected more themselves. Some and the other needs were point of care testing. This is where our health centers would actually purchase testing machines so they could identify on the spot for symptomatic patients and staff whether or not they were affected. COVID positive. When a staff member was identified, they can isolate that staff member, get them into quarantine, so they wouldn't go ahead and you know, spread the virus throughout the health center facility and further reduce their ability to respond to community needs. And also for patients too, as patients came into their clinic, they were able to go ahead and identify those that may have been symptomatic right away, whether or not they may be COVID positive. And lastly, there were some other basic needs that health centers had that weren't being supported by other funding opportunities. And this funding that you provide has been instrumental in helping them address those needs. I'm going to cover those on the next slide very quickly in respect for your time.
We're running out of time. I hate to sort of, but here's what I propose that you do. Show this slide. And I really want to reiterate how delighted we are as a grant a committee of CHIFA that we were able to support you at this very difficult time, and to see how that support you have been able to use it for the benefit of the state of Connecticut and the different communities under your responsibility. I hate to cut the presentation. I know you're very committed. I am very thorough, and it was my fault because I allowed the first presentation to go on. So you didn't get the equal amount of time that you deserve. So my apologies to you. But again, I want to thank you for coming today and showing us how you have used the funding to really make a difference and help the citizens of Connecticut and the in the different regions of the state. Thank you. Thank you so much on behalf of the Grant Committee. And I just want to finish by saying that the Grant Committee will meet again in May. And Peter, I'm sorry for delaying the a little bit the beginning of the regular Grant Committee chief meeting.
No worries, Estella. You know, it's very good information. I wish we could have had a little bit more time for each of the presentations. So no worries. And to Ken and Russell, thank you very much. I am sorry that we had to wind up rather abruptly and quickly, but we certainly do appreciate you taking the time today. Thank you.
We'll be back anytime you want us, and with additional information moving forward on how the grant is making a huge difference in the Connecticut marketplace. So thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for your support of our member health centers. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay. So Estella, would you like a motion to adjourn?
I forgot we had to adjourn officially. I need a motion to adjourn.
I'll move it.
Second.
Okay. Anybody opposed? Since nobody's opposed, we are adjourned.